In the years of being a pastor, one of the things I've gotten to see plenty is are people that experienced a world where they grew up where one or both of their parents never really verbalized the idea that they loved them. And so you always get that sort of feeling like, I'm sure they love me, I think they love me, but I never actually heard them say it. And so I've almost been obsessed in some ways over the last 12 years of having children to make sure, if not daily, certainly regularly, constantly throughout the week, that I find different ways to verbalize, I love you, I love you, I love you. And one of the things that I figured out is when you ask it in the form of a question, it really causes them to cognitively think it through and say, okay, I'm going to verbalize back. So I will do things like this. Who loves you? And then when they were little, especially, they would start with, you know, the mommy, and I'd go, nah, I know she does, but that's not what I want to hear. And I'd tickle them and go down to granddad and grandma and then the cats and the dogs. And then eventually I'd tickle them enough until they're completely out of breath. And then they'll go, daddy, daddy. And then I'll go, that's right. That's what I want to hear. And so when you're drawing it out of them, it forces them to kind of go, I'm loved, I'm loved, I'm loved, I'm loved. And that's very, very important to me. 6 months ago, we had the incredible privilege of becoming parents to the four children that we had the honor to adopt into our home. And being 14, 12, 10, and 8, I realized that I have missed out on all of those years of verbalizing to them, you are loved, you are loved, you are loved. And so I've been really careful to make sure that over the last 6 months, I'm finding different opportunities to do that. And one of them is usually when you're sitting down with one of your children and you just had that talk, you know, the lesson talk or the let's talk about some wisdom talk, that generally after that there's that sort of mood like, and then it's a good time to say, hey, you know I love you, right? Or do I love you? Are you sure I love you? And so I do that. So recently, over the last few months, I kind of bumped into an extraordinary reality I just never anticipated. One time I was sitting down with one of my kids, and we were done with a sort of the big talk thing, and I said to my child, hey, does daddy love you? And I just anticipated the obvious answer, yes. Except that this is the answer I got. I don't know. I don't know. So I was taken back for a second by the answer, but then I thought, okay, hold on a second. Let me explore this further. So I said, why don't you know? Out of curiosity. And the child said, because I cannot see your heart. I cannot see your heart. What a brilliant and extraordinary thing to come out of the mouth of a child. If you're asking me if you love me, I'm going to give you an honest answer. I can't know that. And the reason I can't know that is because I can't see your heart. So you can tell me you love me, but I don't know what your heart actually says. Lots of people say lots of stuff. Talking is easy, but what is going on in here? And so after that moment, it dawned on me that one of the things that I need to do in my lifetime is to make sure I figure out how to make sure my children see my heart. They got to see my heart because he's absolutely right. I don't know. I can't see your heart. And I would argue, yes, you can, but you may not yet have. But I'm going to figure out how to make sure you see my heart. So that one day when I ask, do I love you? You will be able to say, yes. And I'll go, how do you know? And you'll be able to say, because I have seen your heart. The story we're about to get into in the journey that we've been on through the scriptures is perhaps the most extraordinary opportunity that we have as human beings to stare deeply into the heart of God. We get to see his heart today. We get to look at it and go, there it is, there it is. Now you can say whatever you want, but you can't say you haven't seen the heart of God. We get to stare deeply and come face to face with the extravagance of his mercy. That's what we get to do today in the story. And in that moment, when you get to see the heart of someone who says they love you, there is a life-shaping reality that comes with that. It changes everything when we know that we know that we know that we are loved by one that we look up to. So where have we come so far? What have we discovered up to now? We started following Jesus at the moment that he entered into this planet's world. He was conceived in a virgin, and that started sort of odd, right? That's not a normal scenario. And then he was born, and there were angels involved, and there were shepherds traveling, and there were men from the far east coming, and there was a king trying to kill babies, and the entire scenario of circumstances that surrounded the birth of Jesus, not normal. Not normal. We should be going, not normal. Okay, then we bump into him at 12 years old in a temple with a bunch of priests, brilliantly studied rabbis and priests. And what are they saying? This 12-year-old's a prodigy. He teaches with authority. He knows stuff we don't. Where is he from? We want to know. Not normal. Not normal at all. Then we bump into Jesus again when he's being baptized. There's a dove involved, a voice from heaven. There's floating. There's all sorts of cool stuff. And we look at that and go, not normal. Not normal, for sure. Not normal. Then he leaves and he goes into the desert, and for 40 days he doesn't eat or drink anything. And during that time, we discover there's an interaction between the spiritual world and him and the enemy of God and him. Not normal. Then he gets to Nazareth and moves up to Capernaum, and people that are blind start seeing, and sick people get healed, and dead people come back from the dead. There's walking on water stuff. There's demons flying everywhere. Not normal, okay? So as we follow Jesus, what we tend to find is whenever you are in the presence of Jesus, the circumstances surrounding that particular story, not normal. They are not the normal part of our experience on this planet. And so we begin to conclude that it seems as though wherever Jesus shows up, that the gap between what we experience as the natural world and the supernatural, extraordinary world beyond us, the spiritual world, that that gap is completely closed and diminished. It's like it's just there. Everything is happening back and forth. And so we follow the story and we discover that Jesus not only walks through extraordinary circumstances and allows them to happen, but he's also teaching this whole time. And as he's teaching and we're listening, what do we discover? That he's teaching about a place he came from and who he is, and that in fact he is the Messiah, the promised one, the revealed anointed one that will come once and for all to rescue us from the mess we've made in the lives that we've lived, because we know we have lived lives that were sinful, that we're disobedient, and so we've gotten ourselves into a mess. And so we've kind of gotten to the point where we go, Jesus is the promise because he said it, he taught it, he showed it. It's not normal. And then we follow Jesus into Jerusalem, and in the context of where he's walking, the very people that were with him, they're declaring it. Oh, he is the promised one, he's the Messiah. So even through the eyes of history, it is confirmed that Jesus is in fact this promised one. And during this entire journey, as all this is unfolding, we follow him into Jerusalem, into the Last Supper, and it's all coming together for us. He has finally come to rescue his people from the tyranny of the Roman Empire, from the tyranny of any empire in the future, and rise them up to rule forever on this planet. It is going to be the greatest rescue of all time, and we're excited, and that is awesome. And that's where we're at. And throughout this process that we've been watching this happen, we've also discovered along the way that in the spiritual realm, in the domain that we don't get to play with a whole lot in terms of real experience, there is also something occurring. We bump into it on occasion. The enemy of God, known as Lucifer or Satan, the devil, the father of deception, the father of lies, he goes by many different names. This person, who was created originally as one of the great and grand angels in the line and state of Michael and Gabriel and these extraordinary people I can't wait to meet, he was created in that, and he decided to rebel against God's wonder. He was the one that convinced us as humanity to choose to be our own divine rulers, our own gods, and to abandon the reality of bearing the image of our Creator and living our created purpose. He was the one that laid out the path for us to follow. He was the one that was part of that whole story. And we notice in this story of Jesus, he shows up on occasion, and he's doing something very specific. We know from our human perspective, especially if we're on the planet during the time of Jesus, so we don't have the extraordinary privilege of having all this revelation that's been told us, we're just following Jesus, we know that he is now come to rescue. But our version of that rescue is small, right? Because we think he's going to rescue the Jewish people from the tyranny of Rome and rise that up. It's a very small example of a very big work Jesus is going to do. But we recognize he's come to rescue us, he's come to save. The enemy of God also recognizes that Jesus has come to do a work of rescue, that he is the promised one. There was no doubt throughout the New Testament that the demonic world did not know who Jesus was, okay? Jesus never had to explain himself to them. Just so you know, I'm God, you better. It was always like, ah, go away, you're God. I mean, we should sort of get that picture. And so the enemy of God certainly was not under any impression that Jesus was just kind of visiting the planet to go on like a tourist deal and see how people are doing. There was clarity that Jesus was on mission. And so we see the enemy of God starting with the strategy of derailing Jesus from the mission by convincing him otherwise. Kind of an odd deal, but the father of deception deceives himself equally as much as he deceives us. And so he comes in, and in the desert, remember the temptation? Hey, abandon the plan. Just come here, I'll give you everything. You don't need this hassle. You don't need to come and rescue these people. You don't need to do this. Just let that go. And then later on in Scripture, we catch another glimpse of that. Peter is talking to Jesus, and Peter says something to Jesus about this whole dying thing is not certain happen. And what does Jesus say? Get behind me, Peter. No, he says, get behind me, Satan. He says, listen, you can keep talking, but you're not going to convince me to abandon the mission that I've come to complete. So at a certain point in the story, there is this recognition on our part as human beings and on the part of the evil one himself that Jesus intends to complete the mission. The difference is we think it's going to look one way, and he has a very different picture of what he's hoping for. See, when Jesus came to this planet in order to take on the reality of the mission to redeem us from our mess, from sin, from the disease that exists in us that's been passed down from generation to generation that eats us up and destroys us and kills us. In order to do that, God had to make himself one of us. He had to become vulnerable. He had to become weak like we are. He had to be thirsty and hungry and feel pain. He had to suffer and struggle because he had to bear the full weight of sin, which is the consequences that sin has on us, that is constantly eating away at everything that is freedom and life and goodness, and it's just pushing. So he had to become vulnerable. And so as we get ready to step into the story we're about to step into today, you have to recognize we have to watch the story from both domains, from the physical domain of the disciples and the followers looking at Jesus going, what's going on? And from the spiritual domain as the enemy of God watches and then goes, wait a second, and affects and impacts the reality of this story that's unfolding. Because two of these sides together will paint the picture for us of the magnitude of what actually happened to Jesus, what actually happened to God, so that we would have a clarity of the extravagance of his mercy. So let's take a look at what happens. The story unfolds in Matthew 27, Luke 23, and John 19. I did this 2 weeks ago. I'm going to do it again one more time. Usually I'm in Scripture a lot, but because the story expands over 3 chapters and it's all over the place, I would encourage you to read those 3 chapters. Everything I'm going to unpack here, you'll find in there. The Gospels function as a 3D movie, all telling parts of the story that bring the full picture into being. So we're going to be all over the place in there. So just listen to the story and let it unfold before you. So Jesus leaves the Last Supper. Everyone's encouraged. They think the big thing's going to happen. From the point of view of the followers, this is the big moment. Jesus walks down into the valley, into the garden, and the darkness begins to press in, and we all felt it 2 weeks ago, and we feel it as we read Scripture. And suddenly there's a tone that changes from this tone of teaching and pushing forward and rescue to a tone that starts feeling the reality of the whispers of death that might come. In the garden, Jesus is arrested. He is deceived and betrayed by one of his own, which, as you know, when a brother betrays us, one of those that are close to us, it is the most dramatic, isn't it? Because we should have known better, shouldn't we? We should have seen it. When an enemy betrays us, nobody goes, oh. But when a brother does, they kind of go, what were you thinking? You should have seen this. He was right by your side. Of course, Jesus did see it because Jesus said at the table at the Last Supper, he's gonna be the one. So it was sort of obvious, but there is that feeling that it's like, man, how could you let this happen? So he's betrayed, he's arrested, he's taken to trial. We remember as he walked through the trial that there was the slow progression downward from the perspective of the follower. From our human perspective and what knowledge we had, we were watching the promise diminish and the weight of reality start pushing in, that the culture and the society and the leadership and the corruption, everything that is sin and that is death, as it started pressing in, we started watching it crush the reality of Jesus and the promise instead of him rising up and deflecting it like we thought he should. And so we slowly watch this to the point where he's before Pilate, and Pilate throws up his hands and says, fine, you know what? Crucify him. I don't care. Just crucify him. And at that moment, an extraordinary journey begins. A journey that for us as the followers watching, standing by, not having this and the ability to look back from 2012 knowing the whole story, but standing in the story, we watch this progressive failure and breakdown of the promise. From the enemy's perspective, there is this progressive move toward a dream that he has held onto for all of his existence. Jesus is first taken and he is scourged by the Roman government. And the scourging is literally where they take whips, and on the end of the whips, they tie pieces of bone and shell and glass and different things. And then as they beat down on you, it goes into the flesh and tears it away. And so what you have is what you call a scourging. The Roman government was well known to do this on many occasions at such a level that before the person who was to be crucified could go to the crucifixion, they would die at the scourging, which just saved the soldiers the hassle of dragging a person up, nailing them to a cross, putting them up, waiting for them to die. It was really a means by which they went, if we can get it taken care of here, then we don't have to deal with the rest of the story. These were Roman soldiers that did the scourging. These were guys that did 500 push-ups in the morning as part of their warm-up. Do you understand? These are not like little like, hit a pier, hit a pier. These are guys that were bred and built to destroy. And these guys came together and they scourged Jesus. Now, what you're going to begin to see happen is this extraordinary story unfolding where the reality of the weight of everything Jesus has to carry starts bearing down on them. And what we know, as Scripture reveals it to us, is this, that in this moment, God must have seemed, from the vantage point of the spiritual enemy, at his absolute weakest. I mean, think about this, right? Who would have thought that the creator and sustainer of the universe would have come down, made himself flesh and blood, vulnerable and weak to the realities of our humanity, and placed himself in a story where he thought he could step down and take on himself the full weight of sin? Jesus' intent here was to walk in and to take the weight of sin, all of the consequence of sin as it affects us on a daily basis, on a weekly basis, on a lifetime basis, all of the junk it affects, ultimately resulting in our physical death and suffering. He's going to bear all of that weight. Then, simultaneously, he's going to take on the spiritual version of that as well, which is bearing the full weight of the wrath of justice. God's wrath against sin, you understand? So the wrath of justice is going to be borne by God in his most vulnerable state. He's going to be human, and in his humanity and his divinity, he is going to bear the weight. So it is as though we're saying God's going to make himself weaker than anything we can imagine, and then bear the weight of something bigger than anything we can imagine. You with me on that picture? That's what Jesus is stepping into now. And the enemy of God, if I were staring back from this side, I would go, if there's ever a moment, if there's ever a moment that I might be able to kill God, this is that moment. mean, you're never going to have a better opportunity than this to crush God. And there must be a sense for all of us as we are watching this unfold with asking these questions, can he do it? Because maybe, just maybe, God underestimated what he could do in this weak state. I mean, God has never been a man before. Maybe God thinks he can do this, and in fact, it is going to break him. So to make absolutely certain that he is not going to make it through this, since I could not divert him from the plan, let's do this. And we watch as the full weight of sin, all of its consequence in our physical realm, is placed on Jesus. He experiences suffering at levels you and I cannot begin to imagine. And all of the wrath of justice, God's wrath against sin, is affected on Jesus in the spiritual realms. And all of the vengeance of evil is affected on Jesus from the spiritual realm. So think about what Jesus is carrying as he is walking this road we tend to see as a crucifixion. He is carrying the wrath of justice, the weight of sin, and the vengeance of evil. You could not put together a package more devastating than that. That is the whole shebang, folks. There's nothing left to throw at him. That is the kitchen sink and everything in it. It is going, there is a moment in time where I can once and for all crush God, and now is that moment, so I'm going to hold nothing back. Because he is not only choosing to be weak, but he's choosing to take on weight. And so not only is he weak, but he is weighted. And if I bring my vengeance now, we might just pull it off. So Jesus walks into this, and we see the physical expression of this as he is scourged. Then a coat is put around him because they're mocking him and calling him names and saying he's a king. The material rubs against the scourged back. It is incredibly painful. They put a crown of thorns on his head, and then they take a piece of wood, rough, horrible wood, the kind I would tell my kids, don't run your finger down, you're going to get a splinter, and then I'm going to have to pull it out, and there's going to be lots of tears and gnashing of teeth, so don't do that. He puts that cross on his back, and he walks up the hill to the crucifixion. At the crucifixion, they lay him down, and they nail his hands to the cross, and they nail his feet to the cross, and they put the cross up. The word excruciating, have you heard that word before? Excruciating actually is born out of the idea of the cross. Excruciating in its root is the cross, because in the Roman Empire, there was no greater way to make a human being suffer than a death on a cross, because there were so many ways you experienced pain and experienced the process of dying. You were bleeding out because you were nailed to a cross. Your organs inside were dehydrated, so they were shutting down. And if you've ever experienced real dehydration, not the like headache kind, the kind where you're actually out of water, all your organs start shutting down. It is an incredibly painful experience. The muscles in your body start contracting. Everything starts going nuts. You lose control of what's going on in your body, and the pain is unthinkable. While simultaneously, in order to breathe on a cross, because of the position they put you in, you can't just lay there and breathe. To breathe, you have to lift your body up to make room for the lungs to expand. So you have to pull back on your arms every time you want to take a breath. For us human beings, taking a breath is the most fundamental reality of survival in life for us. It is the one fear we hold, that if we're stuck somewhere where we can't breathe, we don't like that. Nobody doesn't panic when they can't breathe past their capacity. And so you are forced to make a decision on the cross to relinquish the innate desire to survive by breathing, because the pain has overridden that desire. In other words, you have too much pain to choose to breathe. So on a cross, you could die of loss of blood, you could die of dehydration, you could die of suffocation. You pick all of the most horrible ways a human being can die, you put them in one package, and it's called the cross. And Jesus is put onto that cross. And while hanging on the cross, a sequence of events occurs. The first in the sequence is that Jesus, while hanging on the cross, calls his mother to him and calls John to him. And he says to John, John, this is your mother. Mother, this is your son. This was a very typical moment where a Jewish man, either husband to a wife or son to a a mother who was the primary caretaker of that woman would pass the responsibility of her care over to a trusted friend or brother, because that was the way that the Jewish culture made sure that they cared deeply for their woman. And so this is a moment where Jesus is passing the baton to John. When do you pass a baton to somebody to take care of your mother? When you are dying, that's right. So the first sequence of events from our vantage point as followers is, why is Jesus passing the mother baton? That means he thinks he's going to die. He's on a cross and things are not going well. He's going down. This is the promise of God. This is the anointed one. God is still with him. We're okay. God is going to do something huge. And Jesus passes the baton. After he passes the baton, Jesus, at a certain point on the cross, looks out and prays to God and says, Father, forgive them because they do not know what they have done. They have no idea what they're doing. When you hear that, we hear it in the context of 2012, having read this. But listen, man, stand under the cross for a second. Who does that kind of stuff? Forgive them. They don't know what they're doing. If you heard that, they have no idea what they've done. If somebody says to you, you have no idea what you've done, is that usually a good thing? Does that sound like a good thing to you? I do this to my kids sometimes. You have no idea what you've done. And I'm holding the broken pieces of some toy of my other child. I'm like, I can't fix it. I can't fix it. They're coming home from school. It's going to be over. Usually we use that statement when something terrible has happened and we're trying to express to people, you probably messed the entire system up. For the follower who hoped that this was going to be the promised one, what would you think if you heard, God, forgive them. They have no idea what they've done. Wouldn't you be thinking, oh my goodness, he was the promised one. He was going to rescue us, but now we've put him on a cross and we've killed him. What have we done? After Jesus says that, there's also this deep sense inside of you that a human being tends to start dealing with the issues of forgiveness and setting people free and asking for forgiveness at their deathbed. I see this all the time. Whenever I've had the privilege of being around people that are in that stage of life toward the end, what is one of the things they want to do? They want to get everyone around them that's ever hurt them or they've ever hurt, and they want to make things right, right? Because it's an important part of who we are to try to do that, because we want to get that stuff out. And Jesus on a cross goes, forgive them, they don't know what they do. All of this is starting to speak to us and go, this is not going well. And then it happens. Jesus on the cross utters these words, Father, Father, why have you forsaken me? Yeah. We have no idea how big that is. Because from our little vantage point as the follower, we hear that and it's big for us. What is big about that? When you are the anointed one, the Messiah, what does the very word Messiah mean? It means anointed one, right? What does it mean to be anointed by God? It means that God has placed all of his support, all of his blessing, all of his presence into you, and he's using you for something great, right? So you would say, if somebody doing something cool for God, you would say, he is anointed of God. How do you know when the anointing is gone? God leaves him, right? Now, if there's this clarity that like, okay, God just left that guy, then he's no longer what? Anointed. You see, by definition, you can't be the anointed one and be forsaken by God simultaneously. So what does it mean that Jesus is forsaken by God as he utters those words? It means that the promise that was ours to receive, the anointed one, is now no longer anointed. He is forsaken. He is the opposite of anointed. From our vantage point, hearing those words, that's what you would hear. He is forsaken. Jesus is giving up. Whatever plan God did have to rescue us, somehow we messed that plan up. I think we all live with that understanding that we think in some way, if we do it big enough and bad enough, we'll mess up the plans of God. And that's exactly how I would have felt in that moment. I would have gone, oh no, we've definitely messed this one up. You know, you have to start wondering, will God ever come back? Is this it? Was this the one shot we had? Like God said, here's my anointed one. He's going to rescue you. Oh, you crucified him. All right, hands off. You're on your own. I mean, don't you get that feeling? But simultaneously, in that moment where Jesus says, Father, Father, why have you forsaken me? From this vantage point, from the vantage point of the spiritual, we see the full impact of that reality. See, God reveals himself to us in the scriptures in a way that he says he exists in triunity. He is the triune God. He is the Trinity. The way that we understand that as the revelation in scripture brings it to us is this, that God exists as one. He is God, but he exists in singular, simultaneously in community. He exists as three persons who is one God. And the reason we find that concept so mysterious, so unthinkable, is because we human beings have no real experiential means by which we can experience that and therefore relate to it. We cannot relate to it because everything we know experientially is singular, and then community exists when two people come together. Two people are not one person. And even when we use language like in marriage, two will become one, we understand that more as sort of the spiritual reality because, you know, there's still two people. I mean, Brooke still goes to the store while I stay home, you know, all that stuff. And so the bottom line is that our experience doesn't allow for us to relate to a being that exists in his nature, in his essence, in his character as community. But for God to be God, for him to embody the divine nature, which is things like God is love, God is justice, God is patience, God is holiness, God is mercy, God is grace. These, when we use these words, the only way those realities could be true of God for all of eternity is if God was also community. In other words, God was able to do something we can't, in that he could express himself to himself in a very real manner. And we go, whoa. Yes, it's because we can't touch it. But we can understand it intellectually as God reveals himself, that he says, listen, I want you to know something about me. My essence, my character, my nature is community. If you take away from me community, you take away from me the reality of who I am. Do you understand? So, if you could hypothetically penetrate God's mercy and demonstrate that God was not mercy, it would immediately remove from the equation the reality of his divinity, and so suddenly he would diminish, and then God would no longer be God. So what if you could penetrate the very nature and character of God? What if you could break God? This is the obsession of God's enemy, to break him so that once and for all, the enemy, Lucifer, can reign as God. And in this moment, on this cross, a moment happens that must have, at least for a second, caused the enemy of God to go, you're kidding me. I think I did it. I think I killed him. I mean, if I were him, I'd have that moment. Do you understand? Because here's what happened. We think God sat in heaven, the Father, and he watched his Son suffer, and the Father's suffering was that the Son was suffering, but it was really Jesus who suffered for us. The only thing we saw Jesus suffer in that the Father didn't take on was in the physical realm of our natural world. Jesus certainly took on the full weight of the consequences of sin in the physical. He carried the cross. He took the scourging. He took the blood. He died. But in the moment that he was forsaken by his Father, it is not two people moving from each other. It is one person being torn apart. Do you understand what I'm saying? Sin and the wrath of justice and the vengeance of evil penetrated the very character and nature of God and tried to tear it apart. What happened when the God of the universe, the creator and sustainer of all things, is torn at the level of character and essence and nature? That's a great question, isn't it? It's a question I don't think any of us could have answered at the time. I don't think that the enemy could have answered at the time. The only thing we could have known is if that happens, the possibility exists that God would cease to be God. And as Jesus is forsaken on the cross, we hear him say, I'm thirsty. They give him a mixture of stuff we'll deal with later. And then he says these words, it is finished. Now, we know the story, so we know that those words hold great power, but listen, those words have the power to be powerful and the power to be devastating, don't they? When we say, I am finished, that could either mean, yes, or it could mean, oh no. Do you understand what I'm saying? And when Jesus is on a cross, nailed to a cross, and the last words out of his mouth were, I'm forsaken, the it is finished doesn't come across positively. Do you understand? As a follower, you don't go, oh, good, good. I'm glad to hear he's finished with whatever he just did because it didn't seem good. That actually comes across as, I'm done. I thought I could, but I couldn't. And we stare into the rubble. This is that scene in the movie, you know, where the superhero at his most vulnerable, he didn't have his super suit on and he wasn't ready and the building fell on him. And the bad guy is standing on top of the building like this. And all of us are staring in, and because we know movies, we know hopefully he'll come back, but we're really not sure because movies have changed these days. And so you're like, maybe he's dead. That's the moment we stand on as we stare at the cross. Both vantage points, the spiritual world and our world, stare at the same moment in the same story, and for the first time we're both on the same page. Maybe he's dead. Maybe we broke him. Maybe it's over. My favorite sort of genre of movies are the superhero movies. I like them. And recently, of course, in the last few years, I've had a very favorable couple of years in the movies business because they've done all the Avengers. I love the Avengers. My favorite of the Avengers is a guy named Hulk. I don't know if you know him, but he's mean and he's green. And I like Hulk because as much as we argue over which Avenger is the most powerful, I mean, there just really isn't any argument when Iron Man says something like this, you've got an army, we've got a Hulk. See, because they see Hulk as an entire army. And so it's a good thing. But here's the cool thing I love about Hulk, okay? Hulk is the guy that's always Bruce Banner, right? This puny little guy that's going about working on science projects, and if you breathe on him, he falls over, right? And inevitably, in the movie, there's always that scene. Anytime you watch a Hulk movie, even in the animations, it's always like this. Bruce Banner gets buried under some pile of rubble or falls out of an airplane and hits the ground, and we all know he's dead. I mean, no human being survives that. And then there's the scene in the movie. It's either the hand or the eyes. It's always the hand or the eyes. It's never different, right? Either the eyes suddenly go, boom, and they turn green, right? Or my favorite is the hand, the puny dead human hand, and then it's like, and then it starts turning green and growing. And it's in that moment that you jump back to the conversation that happened right before the rubble incident. And this was the conversation, usually Bruce Banner going, you shouldn't do this. You shouldn't hit me. It gets bad for everybody. Really, it does. Really. Please don't hurt me. And the bad guy's going, whatever, whatever, right? And then when the green hand comes, we all go, run for your life, because he was right, and he's coming back, and you're in trouble, because when he comes out from under that rubble, he's not the puny little Bruce Banner, he is the army. That's my favorite. I love it. And we get to stand here today knowing that revealed in this is the fact that shortly after Jesus gives his spirit up, shortly after that, there's a dead hand that starts moving and turns green, and it gets very bad for everybody that was on the wrong side. But if we go there and find all of our vision there, we miss the extravagance of the mercy of God and what he did for us. Because this is what we need to remember today, that God became weaker than we ever could have imagined him to become. Then, in his complete weakest state, took on the full weight of sin, the full wrath of justice, the wrath of God, and the full vengeance of evil, simultaneously, while weak, and he was crushed under its weight. And he did that, knowing that it would penetrate the essence of his character and tear at what we might call our soul. It went deep. Sin and wrath and vengeance went deep and tore at the fabric of the divine, the triunity of God. And when he broke there, the unpredictable happened. He did not die. He did not cease to be God. He rose up under the weight and demonstrated to all of us that if that combination of horror could be affected on him simultaneously at his weakest moment, and it was something he rose up under, then you tell me what could possibly stand against God. And then Jesus said to us, I will come over you now, because that weight of sin and wrath and vengeance from the evil one is yours to bear. It is mine to bear. And under its weight, we are damned. We are crushed. We are death. We are darkness. We are gone. But Jesus comes over us now and says, when I become your righteousness, when I become your Savior, when I become your God, I come over you and I take on the weight of all of that. And you live in me. We live and breathe and have our being in Jesus now, because he bears our weight. In all of my ministry years, the single moment that I have noticed that two human beings discover the reality of heart, of love, where they see each other's hearts, is usually in this. When one human being does something terrible to another human being, and then that human being comes and loves them anyway, and forgives them anyway, and sticks with them anyway, I always get to see in those moments that someone gets to see somebody else's heart. If we're talking about how do you see someone's heart, here's the biggest moment. I see it in marriages most often. Two people in a marriage, one person does something dramatic and terrible, hurts and crushes the other person. And then the other person says, I'm crushed and I'm hurt and I'm broken, but that will heal. I love you. I'm with you. Let's do this together. And I always get the same words out of the person who did the terrible thing. They always say, I had no idea how much he or she loved me until now. The time we see people's hearts most extraordinarily is when they do something for us when we do not deserve it, shouldn't have it, and don't have the capacity to fix it. And in this story, Jesus did for us what we could not do in a time that we hated him and we were his enemy. In Romans chapter 5, it says these words. I just want you to listen to this. This is the best description of what we've just experienced. For while we were still weak, verse 6, at the right time, Christ died for the ungodly. For one will scarcely die for a righteous person, though perhaps for a good person one might dare even to die. But God shows his love for us in this, that while we were still his enemies, still sinners, Christ died for us. Christ bore our weight, and he rescued us from it. This is the extravagant mercy of God. And I leave you with this thought as we close out. When we discover God's extravagant mercy, this should be the response. In this devotional by Chris T. Green, he says this, God desires to be known among other things by his mercy. Not just mercy, in fact, but in extravagant mercy. Incomprehensible, extravagant mercy. Mind-boggling mercy. The kind of mercy that bridges such a vast expanse that those who see it are compelled to fall on their faces in gratitude and worship. Do you know this mercy? When we discover the full implications of the mercy of God, what he has done for us, in view of God's mercy, it changes everything. And we live under that freedom. That when we feel the weight that we carry, we remember that right over us, Jesus carries the weight of all of it. And our circumstances and our burdens, as weighty as they may feel sometimes, are but a shadow of what Jesus has borne on our behalf. They will not crush us, because what will crush us has already been taken on by the one who can bear its weight. That is an extravagant mercy. Let's pray. God, as we stand here, lingering for a moment at the rubble under which you were buried, staring at the fact that you just took on the wrath of justice, the weight of sin, and the vengeance of evil simultaneously while you were at your weakest in flesh and blood. You felt it, and you experienced it, and you bore it. And then in that moment, the very essence of who you are was penetrated on behalf of what we should have experienced. You broke for us, Father. You broke for us, Spirit. You broke for us, Jesus. You allowed sin and wrath and vengeance to violate you because you had the power to consume it and to redeem it. And we are free because you bear the weight of our death. May we fix our eyes on your extravagant mercy. And as we bear the circumstances and the burdens that you have called us into on this life, may we not be discouraged. May we not crush under them, but may we be reminded that they are now only as heavy as you already know we can bear, because you are bearing the weight that has the power to crush us. May we trust in you and trust in your rescue of us so that we would live on mission for your kingdom and the glory of your name. We love you, Jesus.